If it hasn't become clear yet this week, it's not a newfound affinity for cannabis culture and a sudden tolerance of recreational drug users that has driven Canada to embrace marijuana legalization. It's money. Remember that estimated $5.7 billion in black market cash from our first episode this week? That was last year. This year, Canadians will spend even more on pot. And now that it's no longer confined to the shadows, the usual suspects have begun to fight over the pie. A year or two ago, when legal pot was just a hazy line on the horizon, a lot of people spent a lot of time picturing what this industry would look like. There wasn't one at the time, so it could have been anything. A meritocracy, where the best ideas win, an equal seat at the table for female executives who are busy creating some of the coolest new products, or finally some representation for people of color in the boardroom. After all, they'd suffered the most and learned the most on the long road to legalization. But now, pot is legal, and there are billions to be made. And what do you think the C-suite at the hottest cannabis companies look like right now? You can probably picture it. So what happened to the industry that was supposed to be a new day for executive equality? Money happened. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Pot Week, Day 4. The Green Rush.
I think we were like really optimistic about what was going to happen and all of the idea of opportunity, and we didn't necessarily think about the realities of business.
Stacey Lee Kong of Flare.com has spent the past couple of months talking to some of the biggest innovators in the industry, the biggest advocates for equality, and the people who analyze how and why money gets invested in ideas. So Stacey, first explain the Green Rush.
So the Green Rush is all of those smart business people and entrepreneurs who are like, oh, okay, so cannabis is happening and we need to get in on that. We need to start a cool company, and tons of people have so far.
What kinds of companies exist out there that are like, I obviously understand there's, you know, companies that grow your weed and companies that package it and companies that, you know, deliver shipments and roll joints and all that kind of stuff. What are the other business opportunities and why are people so insanely excited about it?
Because there's all these cool ancillary services. Like, yes, there are LPs and that's a huge opportunity. And that's
what's an
LP? It's a licensed producer. So
okay.
The people who are actually growing, they're making this weed for you.
And everybody else is ancillary.
Everybody else is ancillary. So if you're talking about, for example, there's this really cool company called Lift & Co. And they are like kind of a travel zoo for weed. So right now they're focused on medical marijuana. And you can go on and leave a review and say, this was really good for my pain, but it made me kind of stressed out, or it was really relaxing, or all these different, like they have different categories. And so you can log on as someone who's maybe not a huge cannabis user and say, okay, this is the impact I'm looking for. Here's what I want to, here's the strain I should try.
Right, like Yelp, essentially.
Yes, actually Travel Zoo is not the right, it's really like Yelp for cannabis. And that to me is slightly hilarious because can you imagine, I'm not a huge weed smoker, but I do feel like it would be really funny to be me high being like, okay, what's my review? Is this like a 5 out of 10, a 7 out of 10? Like it's going to be hilarious.
So sites like that already exist for all sorts of other intoxicants, right? Like I read bourbon sites.
Exactly.
Like that. People who are into it take it extremely seriously.
Absolutely. But I think there's also an opportunity for people who are not super into it, who are just dipping their toe into it. Because stigma is a huge, especially for women, stigma is a huge deterrent from trying cannabis, especially if you're not like 17.
Yeah.
So there's all this opportunity for cannabis delivery services or cannabis skincare or cannabis tourism opportunities, like all these things that I think will, as the stigma lessens, people will become more and more interested in all of these other lifestyle aspects of cannabis.
So right now we're just at the beginning kind of the Green Rush. I guess it's been the last, what, year or so?
Yeah, I would say a year since we've known a date, and probably a year and a half, because people knew it was coming before there was an official announcement.
Right. And what did we think the industry would look like back when this kind of thing started and it was, you know, the wild, wild west and anybody with an idea could get in?
I don't know that anyone knew. I think that is the big thing, is that it has for so long been the wild, wild west. So it's interesting. There's a National Post story about how cannabis was moving from the black market to the gray market. And so the black market is obviously like gangs and like straight up hardcore criminals. But edibles, for example, are not legal.
Right.
As of yet, even though other types of cannabis are, I truly think it has been the Wild Wild West for so long that there's not a strong, like, this is exactly how things are going to unfold. And even now, you know, in the days leading up to legalization, we didn't know exactly what it was going to look like.
Right.
But I do think there was a feeling of like anyone could get in, that there were so many opportunities and so many cool things were going to happen. And if you had a great idea, you could probably make it happen.
And so now that we've hit D-Day, and I know there's lots to come still, but what does the industry look like?
You know, you'd be really surprised to hear, or maybe not surprised at all, to hear that it looks quite a lot like many other industries. So where the money comes from, who the leadership is, it's not so different.
Be blatant in what you mean
by that.
So
like white dudes.
Okay.
White dudes are running things. And
but people didn't think it was going to be that way.
No. People, and especially if you were reading, I would say like last fall when you were reading stories, I feel like there were so many stories about how women were going to change everything. Women were going to be the people who really drove this industry. And there was a Newsweek story from 2015 that The Takeaway, which is a podcast from a New York public radio station, so they re-upped that question. So in 2015, Newsweek was asking whether cannabis was going to be the first billion-dollar industry that was dominated by women. And that's a really lovely thought. I like that thought a lot.
Yeah.
I don't think that we are there yet. And I'm not sure, you know, there's a risk that that may not happen.
So how did it happen? How did we get from industry pieces and industry analysts kind of looking at it and saying, all right, anybody with a good idea, which means it could be dominated by women, especially because of these ancillary opportunities, all that stuff. How did it end up being dominated by white dudes again then? Something happened there.
Yeah, money happened. So where the money comes from, who the investors are, really shapes the leadership of companies, right? So if money is coming from traditional sectors, if money is coming from, you know, hedge funds in Canada or banks or any sort of traditionally white, male, heteronormative industry, there's research that shows that those people, those investors are going to look for people like them mm-hmm. to invest in. It's who you know still. But then the other part of that is that those people don't often take women of color in particular or women seriously. They don't necessarily see the success that they have had as a business. They don't see that women might be able to replicate that because maybe there's a different leadership style, or maybe you don't come in as a cowboy talking about, you know, how women actually sell their businesses is different than how men do. And so there's research from an interesting project called the Diana Project that says that women-led companies are more successful at getting investment from any type of firm that has a woman on its executive leadership as well. So, like, women are helping other women out, mm-hmm. but there are not that many women who are investors. So it's like this whole very complicated kind of octopus of a problem where there's all these different factors, but what it comes down to is that women, particularly women of color, aren't necessarily getting the money they need. And they're also not necessarily, even if they don't want to become entrepreneurs, as cannabis companies become more established, they're not necessarily on the senior leadership of those companies either. So there's like an entrepreneurial problem. There's a diversity problem among the like sort of C-suite executives.
Right. It's a similar problem that lots of companies and industries
Absolutely.
Have.
And I think
so why did we think it was going to be different? I'm sorry, I cut you off.
No,
there,
but I was going to say the same thing. Like, why did we think this? I think we were like really optimistic about what was going to happen and all of the idea of opportunity. And we didn't necessarily think about the realities of business. The people who are going to get into investing, like, it's not going to be me. I have $5.
Right.
So we're kind of taking these old models of investment and we're applying it to this new cowboy Wild Wild West industry. The industry necessarily sort of becomes that old school way of doing things.
And what do we lose in a new industry like this when we're relying on old money and traditional ways for startups?
All those new ideas.
Give me some examples.
So even actually, you know, I think there is the cool company perspective, but there's also the inclusivity perspective. So when women of color don't get opportunities, then they don't get to turn around and help other women of color up. When people of color in general don't get these opportunities, they're not just missing opportunities for the money. They're also missing opportunities because of these other sort of societal things that are the same things that keep us out of lots of different industries. So the thing that is unique about cannabis is that there's a long history of people of color who know lots about cannabis, who know lots about growing the plant, who know lots about like the best way to cultivate this particular strain. But they don't necessarily have a chance to transition out of the gray or black market because maybe they have a cannabis conviction. Maybe they know someone who has a cannabis conviction. So like we lose some institutional knowledge. We lose this opportunity to have – you just have better ideas when there's lots of people at the table and you can kind of vibe off one another and say, oh, well, from my perspective, this, and from your perspective, this. And you come up with an idea that is better than the sum of its parts. But if everyone at the table has the same kind of perspective, you're not going to end up with the best idea. You're going to end up with a good idea, but not necessarily what it could be if you had all of these diverse voices.
I was hoping we'd get to the relationship between marijuana and people of color in general, because the history is not a great one. And I want to know what people in the industry who are hoping to gain investment or hoping to even just get into it have to say about that. And if they've seen, if they've literally seen any of those kind of barriers in their way or, you know.
They really have. So I spoke to several different women from BC, from Ontario, from Alberta, and everyone kind of had a similar story to tell about not being able to or not feeling like they were really welcome in this industry.
And these are women who are actively trying to enter the industry.
So it's women who are advocating usually. So I think there's this, like, for example, there's a woman named Carolyn Tinglin. She's out in BC and she has this organization who the whole goal of the organization is to improve diversity, to have more women of color, to have more people of color in general. She has a really powerful, she has powerful stuff to say about what it's like to know that your cousin went to jail for 10 years because they had a joint on them and what that means when you're thinking about whether this is a viable place that you can go. So it's actually about people seeing themselves in this industry. It's not even – I mean, obviously, there are people who want to get in and are facing these barriers about investment or about even the know-how of how to start a business.
Right.
But there are incubators out there that can help people. I think one of the bigger barriers is – do you see yourself here? Do you see that you could be part of this industry? Because in general, the people who are, I mean, they don't look like me.
Yeah. So I went to a local dispensary near me on the weekend, the weekend right before pot became legal, because I wanted to just see what they were going to do, right? And everybody who runs that dispensary is Black. And I asked them what they were planning to do, because in Ontario, at least before legalization, the government said, you have to shut down or you'll lose your chance at ever having a permanent license to sell legally. So I asked one of the guys who runs the place, are you guys going to shut down? He said, no. I said, well, why not? You know that you're going to be, you know, ruled out of getting a license. He's like, they're not going to give me a license anyway. So I'm just going to stay open as long as I can.
Exactly. And whether
I don't know whether that was self-selected or whether he had a previous, obviously we didn't get into his previous background, but he said he knew that he would never get a legal license, so he might as well continue to do this.
Whether that's true or not, whether he's right or not, maybe licenses are going to be handed out like candy, who knows? But there is this lasting perception that people of color aren't going to get a fair shake. That doesn't mean that people are being, you know, they're like being dramatic or they don't know what they're talking about. That's based on years, decades, generations of proof that people of color have not gotten a fair shake. So when we know that Black and Indigenous people are far more likely to have cannabis possession charges and convictions than white people, even though the rate that everyone smokes is pretty similar, you know that, you know, there's some proof. There's all these things. So maybe it is all self-selection. Maybe somehow the government is going to be completely on the up and up and there's going to be no bias in any of these processes. I think that's unlikely based on the entire history of Canada. But say that's the case. The fact that that's the history of Canada means that people are not going to turn around and put their hand up because it's still a risky sector to get into.
If the government and the authorities have traditionally been so much harder on people of color when it comes to cannabis, how are we expecting the just announced pardon opportunity to work? Do you think it will be proportionally more people of color taking advantage of that opportunity? Is that actually a good opportunity?
You know, okay, I think it is good news. I do think it's a nice thing, but I'm a little suspicious because it's not really what people have been asking for. What people have been asking for is amnesty. And that means that it's like the crime did not happen. So it's not that you have been convicted and you're being forgiven, which is what a pardon is. your criminal record is expunged. And the key thing there is that when you have been pardoned, you still have to tick the box on your job applications, on your apartment applications that say that you have been convicted of a crime. And that's what keeps a lot of people who are from marginalized communities out of good jobs and out of good apartments. And it has this lasting impact. So a pardon doesn't fix any of those things. And it doesn't fix that systemic inequality. Whereas amnesty and expunging your criminal record so that it's like it didn't happen, it doesn't exist, that would go much further. And I think that's the problem, where this is a good thing. I don't think it's bad, obviously, but it's not quite far enough.
And it's not going to somehow offer a leg up in terms of the things that you've mentioned that tend to keep people of color out of the industry.
You know, I don't know for sure, obviously, but I kind of suspect it won't, because it doesn't address the systemic inequality. And it doesn't address the thing that might make someone self-select out, is that they don't see themselves. They don't feel like they belong in this industry, because you're still a criminal. The fact of the matter is, a pardon is not amnesty.
How does this change while it's still kind of a malleable industry?
I do think a big part of it is it's going to take the time for stigma to lessen. And that's a big learning that we have for women in general. The lifestyle brand Vanderpop did a survey earlier this year where they were talking about, they surveyed 1,500 North American women, and something like 70-something percent said that they are concerned about stigma. That is the biggest reason why they may not, if they do partake, they may not admit to it. They may not partake. Like, that's the barrier there. As cannabis becomes more normalized, as more people of color and more women of color get into the industry, and it becomes less a, oh, you know, weed, it's this like slightly contentious thing, and more, yeah, cannabis, in the same way that you might get into beer, in the same way that you might get into bourbon.
As you have more and more of those Yelps and people become more serious about their consumption and et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. And the more it becomes a thing that you don't have to hide, I think that will help a lot, but it will take time. And I'm not sure that without real advocacy and without amnesty, to be honest, I'm not sure that people are ever going to feel 100% comfortable.
Thanks, Stacey.
No problem.
Stacey Lee Kong from Flare.com. That was The Big Story. Pot Week, day 4, we have 1 day left. And the last day is about your questions. We asked you earlier this week what we should be talking about and what you wanted to know now that the day finally arrived. And we've got a bunch of really good ones, but we can always use a couple more. So if there's a burning question that you've had since 12:01 a.m. on Wednesday, please send it to us. You can visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca, and you can hit the contact us button and email, or you can hit us up on social media at Big Story Podcast on Twitter, on Facebook, and on Instagram. And of course, we are everywhere, as always, that you get podcasts. Apple, Google, Stitcher. Find us there. Rate us. Tell us what you thought of Pot Week. And tell a friend. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.